Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, has said he supports dictatorship and torture, that religious and ethnic minorities must fit in or simply disappear, that his political opponents should leave or go to jail, that the only problem with Brazil's military dictatorship is that they didn't kill enough people, that police should have carte blanche to kill whoever they like, and that he'd rather his own son be dead than be gay. The analysis offered by a Washington Post headline then that, quote, Bolsonaro's victory may mean further shifts in tolerance and moderation, close quote, might seem to be a bad joke, were it not that such pieces are all some U.S. media consumers may encounter. Migrants at the southern border seeking asylum from violence fomented by U.S. policy underscore that we really are one world, interrelated. So how are U.S. readers to understand what's happening in Brazil and its American flag-saluting, rape-joke-making, Hitler-admiring president? We talked this week with Brian Meir. He's an editor at Brazil Wire, as well as a freelance writer and producer. He also edited the book Voices of the Brazilian Left, a collection of interviews. He'll join us from Brazil, where he's lived for more than two decades. The Brazilian election and what comes next, this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Looking back at the recent Brazilian election, it's hard not to focus on Jair Bolsonaro himself, with his defense of a brutal dictatorship and his encouragement of violence against perceived others. But journalists should spare some critical attention for the election itself, which saw the leading candidate, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of the PT, or Workers' Party, jailed and bumped from the race, under circumstances that warrant more attention than U.S. media have seen fit to provide. You may have heard that Bolsonaro is a Trump admirer, but the relationship between anti-democracy in Brazil and the U.S. goes well beyond that. Here to help us understand some of this is Brian Meir. He's an editor at Brazil Wire and editor of the book Voices of the Brazilian Left. He's a regular correspondent for the radio show This Is Hell, as well as a freelance writer and producer. He joins us now by phone from Sao Paulo. Welcome to Counterspin, Brian Meir.
Hi, how are you?
Well, when twice elected Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff was being pushed out in what many called a legislative coup, U.S. readers weren't reading quotes from the Organization of American States, for example, that was saying that this was not kosher, nor were they hearing about the objections of neighboring countries, some of whom pulled their ambassadors in protest, except perhaps via headlines like USA Today's Leftist Leaders Leap to Defense of Ousted Brazilian President. So U.S. readers were set up kind of weirdly for this election. Corruption was associated, if vaguely, with Dilma. And then when her successor, Michel Temer, was clearly embroiled in stuff, Brazil was dismissed, as the New York Times put it, as just a, quote, turmoil-prone nation, close quote. So then with the election itself, I mean, we heard about it, but the big picture problems with it, like the leading candidate being in jail, were treated as externalities. What do you think that U.S. listeners should know about the Brazilian election? What complicates the idea that Bolsonaro is a simple expression of what Brazilians want?
Well, I guess the main point is that the leading candidate was arrested as part of a U.S. cooperative anti-corruption investigation between the U.S. Department of Justice and the Brazilian Public Prosecutor's Office. Now, he was arrested with no material evidence, and the main beneficiaries of the fact that he and the PT party were removed from the race this year are American corporations. And so I think that Americans should know that their government, their corporations, had a hand in what's happening down here and had a hand in the return to fascism. And I guess a second point is just that Bolsonaro is not the Brazilian Trump. He shouldn't be normalized. Some Americans might think, well, Trump's terrible, but, you know, the United States hasn't crashed and burned since he took office. So Bolsonaro come to office in Brazil probably won't be that big of a deal either. But it's not the case. He's not a Brazilian Trump. He's a fascist. He's, you know, Trump may say some things that are fascist, but Jair Bolsonaro is literally a former official from a neo-fascist military government, you know, that ruled as a state of exception. They used to, for example, categorize all people as workers or bums. So if you were walking down the street, unable to prove to a policeman that you had a job through showing documentation proving that, you would get arrested during the dictatorship. That's not something that's happening under Trump. Brazil under Bolsonaro won't be like the U.S. under Trump. It will be more repressive.
Just want to ask you one other question about Lula, because I think people had heard that Lula da Silva was in jail, but I think they might not understand how that happened. And for example, a Washington Post news story I was quoting before from an op-ed, an analysis piece, but in their, you know, straight news story, the Washington Post said that Lula's, quote, re-election bid was upended when he landed in jail this year on corruption charges, close quote. There are very particular factors about Lula not just being in jail, but not being able to run from jail.
Well, yeah, exactly. The coverage has been really misleading. It's unfortunate. What especially bothers me is the way it's misleading in publications that have progressive readers. I mean, I can understand Fox News or something giving misleading, slanted coverage against Lula because he's a leftist. But it's very frustrating to see Washington Post, New York Times, NPR run this innuendo and these semi-truths and mistruths about why Lula was arrested. The fact is that he was convicted of committing undetermined acts. The judge, Sergio Moro, who's the leader of this U.S. Department of Justice, Brazilian Public Prosecutor's joint operation called Operation Car Wash, was allowed to rule on his own investigation with no jury. In eccentric Brazilian legal tradition, which goes back to the Inquisition, his literal title is that of inquisitor. He set up the investigation, and he was allowed to judge on his own multi-year investigation, okay? And the ruling was that they could not define any specific act of corruption that Lula committed. First, they accused him of being involved in Petrobras petroleum company corruption. That charge was removed from the court case 2 years ago. The day Lula was arrested, The Guardian said that his arrest was connected to Petrobras corruption, which is erroneous. It was not. In fact, the judge said that it specifically there was no Petrobras connection in the ruling. His corruption charges were connected to supposed illegal reforms in a beachfront apartment. The courts were unable to prove that Lula ever owned the apartment. The apartment is registered in the name of the building company that built the building. They were unable to prove that he ever visited the apartment, and they were unable to prove that any reforms actually took place. Nevertheless, even if he had received a free apartment and gotten these reforms that clearly didn't happen because they've taken pictures inside the apartment, it's a mess. Even if that had happened, the date that they alleged this all took place was after he left office, so there was no way of proving quid pro quo. Furthermore, the case is handled in Curitiba, Paraná, a neighboring state in a local court, which has no jurisdiction in the town where the apartment exists. So it's just full of improprieties. And I feel like what you see these days with a lot of journalism is it's almost just like PR that they repeat in a lot of papers when they talk about foreign news. I didn't see any journalist for a major American newspaper do any kind of investigative work on this, weighing the merits of the case against Lula or not. They just kept repeating what the prosecution was saying the whole time. And the ironic thing is it's not even the first time that a former Brazilian president has had his life destroyed over phony allegations involving reforms on an apartment. Because when the military dictatorship took office in 1964, the media spent a year and a half accusing former president Juscelino Kubitschek, who was still very popular at the time, of having received illegal reforms on a luxury apartment in Ipanema. And after a year and a half, it came out that he was never the owner of the apartment. So they didn't even invent an original way to arrest Lula.
Well, and you're right, of course, that in U.S. reporting on the election, that was, to say underexplored is to say too little. We saw phrases as the like in that Washington Post story, well, Lula landed in jail, and there was definitely assumption that he deserved to be there, you know, and that should not be factored in when we were thinking about what would happen with the election. Well, another thing that I was surprised by was in a Washington Post news story, it was really focused about Bolsonaro's social media-centered campaign. You know, he overcame challenges with the power of social media, speaking directly to voters. We were told that backers became voracious consumers of his missives on Twitter and WhatsApp, where we're told white men and wealthy voters, eager to turn the page after a decade of left-wing rule, rallied to Bolsonaro's side. This Washington Post piece had space for how Bolsonaro grew up a nerdy kid in a German-Italian family, but they didn't have any mention of the slush fund, which other accounts have led me to understand was reportedly used to fund this social media campaign that the Post is profiling, and that was also super hateful, was it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, first of all, start from the starting point that when Lula was removed from the presidential race illegally against the orders of the UN Human Rights Committee, which are legally binding in Brazil because Brazil signed the Second Optional Protocol on Political and Civil Rights, the UN. When Lula was pulled out of the race, he'd been behind bars for 2.5 months in solitary confinement, prohibited from speaking to the press, and he still had more. He was polling higher than every other candidate combined in the polls. He had more than double the support of Bolsonaro when he was removed from the race a month before the election. Okay, so then you look at what Bolsonaro did. Steve Bannon apparently was helping a little bit with this. They set up an illegal campaign slush fund that had over 4 times the monetary value in it as Bolsonaro's entire official campaign fund. And they used it to illegally obtain personal data on targeted segments of WhatsApp users. Brazil is the biggest consumer of this WhatsApp social media app in the world. Over half of all Brazilians use it. And so they created thousands and thousands of WhatsApp groups of 256 people each, specifically targeted to certain demographics, like evangelical Christian women, for example. And they just bombarded them with slander and hate speech. Okay, so for example, there was a poll that came out that said 87% of the people who voted for Bolsonaro believe that when the PT party was in power, they created a gay kit and distributed it in the public school system to try to convince children to become homosexuals. 87%, okay? They were spreading information that Fernando Haddad, who was Lula's replacement candidate, was a child molester. They said that if Haddad was elected, the government was going to create a kind of panel that would declare whether children were gay or not at the age of 5. And they bombarded evangelical Christians with this. And so the main reason that Bolsonaro was elected was because 87% of his voters thought that Fernando Haddad's government would try to make their children gay, you know, because their brains are just fried by this illegal use of social media apps. Just like in the US, you have all these Americans now who think the earth is flat. You know, it's like this kind of thing. So it's hardly, as they're saying in the media, oh, Brazilians are worried about violence. Brazilians, you know, they're worried about corruption. That wasn't it. It was straight up, you know, homophobia was like the main social media factor in getting Bolsonaro elected. Another thing they did was, I don't know if you saw these not him protests that happened all over the world, right? Mm-hmm. On the day of those protests, Bolsonaro's people took these photos from slut walk protests that happened, you know, a year earlier, of, you know, how slut walk is, topless women, women in lingerie kissing and stuff like that. And they bombarded millions of Brazilians with images from slut walk, saying that these were live photos taken in the Not Him protests. And so immediately after this, after the Not Him protests, which were huge protests, also underreported in the media, there was at least 1 million people on the streets in Brazil, 150,000 in São Paulo alone. And American newspapers were saying tens of thousands of people nationwide, right? Huge protests. After they ended, Bolsonaro gained 5 percentage points in the polls with women because they bombarded evangelical Christian women with these slut walk photos.
So there's a lot missing from U.S. media coverage of the election itself. But then what was in it was, in some cases, just craven is the word that comes to mind. We talked a couple of weeks back on the show about U.S. financial media, kind of the business pages. You know, the New York Times had a story in the business section. Brazil's markets have surged on hope of Bolsonaro victory. Can he deliver? And the concern in that Times story was that Bolsonaro might not actually follow through on his plans to cut pensions, you know, and to cut Social Security, though they said markets are optimistic. There's at least a kind of frankness in that business reporting, you know, that straight up says, we don't care about fascism as long as, you know, the bottom line is happy. But straight news pieces tend to kind of take that investor point of view, but then they try to retrofit some kind of democratic principle in there. And so you certainly wouldn't get a sense of U.S. involvement, U.S. meddling in Brazilian politics, which you're talking about this time around. It's certainly not the first time in terms of U.S. Meddling there.
Yeah, of course not. In fact, I mean, let's be frank, there aren't really any countries in Latin America that the U.S. doesn't meddle in.
Right, right.
I mean, there was a Harvard Review article published in the 90s which counted 44 U.S.-backed coups in Latin America between 1898 and 1994. And so we're in a situation where the U.S. was involved in the 1964 coup in Brazil and actively supported the dictatorship, which lasted until 1985. Bolsonaro was a member of that government, and he's appointing 3 former generals who were also active during the dictatorship to cabinet positions. I mean, that alone shows there's, at the very least, a hangover right. of U.S. meddling in this current situation, not even taking into account the joint Department of Justice, SEC, Brazilian Public Prosecutor's Operation Car Wash, which the U.S., Department of Justice and SEC have collected over $1 billion in fines from Brazilian companies so far through this investigation. And at the Atlantic Council last year, Kenneth Blanco, who was acting assistant state's attorney, gave a speech, acting assistant attorney general, sorry, he gave a speech in which he talked about illegal collaboration that was going on between the Department of Justice and Sergio Moro, who was the Operation Car Wash director, and his team. He didn't use the word illegal, but he said there was constant informal communication, which made the processes more agile. And he bragged about them arresting Lula in this speech. It's all on, you can watch it online. The problem is informal communication with foreign government officials is a crime in Brazil. So Lula's defense lawyers used that to file a motion for dismissing the entire case, which is bogged down in the courts now. But I mean, they're openly admitting that they've engaged in illegal communications with the Brazilian government in this case. So it's not even a case of like speculating that the U.S. is involved in it. Operation Car Wash was used to destabilize Dilma Rousseff's government before the 2016 coup. They couldn't find any crimes to connect her with on it. So she was impeached on a budgetary infraction that was legalized by the Senate 1 week after she left office, called fiscal peddling. But her name was certainly dragged through the mud in the American media related to this Operation Car Wash. The week before the 2014 presidential elections, the New York Times associated her with Petrobras petroleum corruption, which was under investigation, Operation Car Wash, in eight different times, you know? So this American-Brazilian joint operation was a key factor in taking Dilma Rousseff out of office and removing Lula from the – arresting Lula and removing him from the elections. And now the man in charge of it, Sergio Moro, who was hailed as an anti-corruption crusader in the American media for 2 years, has accepted the justice minister position in Bolsonaro's neo-fascist government. So he's been a political actor all along. I mean, it's just it's outrageous that the man who removed the leading candidate from the elections is now taking a cabinet position with the candidate who he helped.
It does boggle, you know, and on the point of U.S. intervention, which, you know, the U.S. corporate media's history of looking the other way on that, of course, is clear. But there also is concern, therefore, about the regional and international impact of Bolsonaro's coming to power, because some people were looking to South America as maybe offering a kind of alternative, as maybe building power that could serve as a counter in the hemisphere to the United States. But now it looks like Bolsonaro maybe is going to be pulling back or pulling out of things like BRICS, for example.
Definitely. No, he's really bungling things up, you know, in terms of Brazil's role on the world stage. Lula, you know, in addition to lifting 40 million people above the poverty line, which is no small feat in a country like Brazil, and ending the hunger crisis, what he did was he, on the foreign policy level, he really reached out to other countries around the world to build some kind of alternative to just relying on the U.S. Now, during the Cold War, when the dictatorship was in power, Brazil was heavily dependent on the U.S. for everything, you know. But the world's changed, and the U.S. isn't even Brazil's largest trade partner anymore. Bolsonaro got in trouble mimicking some of Trump's ridiculous rhetoric against Chinese, you know. And China just stepped in and said, "Look, we'll pull out. You know, if you guys start badmouthing us, we just want to remind you that we're your largest trade partner."
Right.
You know. You can only get so far copying Trump on a foreign policy level and, you know, thinking you're going to depend entirely on the U.S. You know, the world's changed since the 1980s when he was a military dictatorship official.
You and others like Glenn Greenwald have underscored that Bolsonaro is not the Brazilian Trump, that you have to pay attention to the differences there. But in a sense, like Donald Trump, Bolsonaro did go from punchline to president, including with TV hosts now saying they were sorry they had him on, you know, back in the day. One said she only had him on so often because she was trying to make fun of him and show the low level of representatives we're electing, you know. I'm guessing that it was these voids that we're talking about in the media conversation, not just about Bolsonaro, but about the various elements of Brazilian politics. That's part of what encouraged you to work on this book, Voices of the Brazilian Left. Can you tell us finally a little bit about that and what work you hope that book can do?
Okay, well, this actually kind of responded to what I feel were big holes in the progressive media coverage of Brazil, because there's this kind of false narrative that started when Lula was still president, often focused on, you know, the World Cup and the Olympics and some problems that were related to those issues. And it's issues that I was very involved with. I wrote a book in Portuguese about the Olympics and human rights abuses and stuff. But they were used to kind of develop this narrative that Lula was kind of like a Tony Blair of Brazil, that he was someone who had, you know, who used to be a leftist. And when he took power, he became a neoliberal and turned his back on the labor unions and the social movements. And that this, you know, this is why people were getting upset with his government and blah, blah, blah. And like the one thing these people had in common, and I'm talking about publications like even The Nation and even NACLA, which I write for sometimes, and Jacobin, publishing this kind of stuff that didn't really explain what was going on, right? And the one thing they all had in common is like no one was ever talking to anyone from social movements or labor unions. And so I came up with this idea of Voices of the Brazilian Left to interview key people from the unions and the social movements about what's happening in Brazil during the lead up and aftermath of the 2016 coup. Of course, everyone in the MST the CUT, Labor Union Federation, the Urban Social Movements, everyone was critical of the PT and Lula, but they didn't abandon them. They said, look, this is the best we could do at the time. You know, like the people don't realize that, for example, during 13 years of PT government rule, they never had more than 22% representation in Congress. And so they could only get things passed by going into coalition. The problem with this narrative that Lula and the PT were neoliberal is then it gives this misconception in the mind of the casual reader that neoliberalism caused 40 million people to move out of poverty. And that's never happened anywhere in the world. The main reason that poverty dropped in Brazil was because of over 100% minimum wage hikes adjusted for inflation. In dollar terms, when Lula took office, the minimum salary was like $50 a month. When he left office, it was over $300 a month. That's why 40 million people, the main reason at least, why 40 million people rose above the poverty line. That's not neoliberal at all. One of the key tenets of neoliberalism is minimum wage suppression, right? It's a long answer probably, but so I decided that since no one in the North was interviewing these people, someone should, and that's why I decided to do this book, yeah. Because there's a lot of nuance, yeah. I mean, Lula and Dilma were not radical leftists, but it really does a disservice to the labor unions and the social movements who support the PT party to say that they're just straight up neoliberals.
And it does a disservice to anyone's understanding in general of Brazilian politics. You won't understand what happens next if you imagine that people are responding to something that's different than what they are in fact responding to.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we've been speaking with Brian Meir. He's an editor at Brazil Wire. They're online at BrazilWire.com. And that's also the place you can get information on the book Voices of the Brazilian Left. Brian Meir, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.